He still wears the same robe, the color, the fabric, the way it folds over his shoulder, unchanged, so that to anyone watching, he looks exactly as he did before the war, a Roman senator, a man of standing, a voice in the Republic. But as he steps into the chamber, he already knows that none of that is entirely true anymore. He had back to Pompeii, not recklessly and not out of blind loyalty, but after weighing the situation carefully and convincing himself that he was defending something larger than any one man. The Republic, its balance, its traditions, the things that had defined his entire life. Now Pompey is dead, and he is still here.
Welcome to the Mammoth in the Room podcast, where we share real-life stories about leadership and their underlying human behavior rooted in science and research. We unpack and interpret the evolutionary forces behind it to help you to better lead your people for outstanding business results.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Mammoth in the Room, where we explore leadership lessons that stand the test of time, using history and neuroscience to explain the human behavior behind pivotal decisions, because those same patterns still shape how leaders and teams succeed or fail in organizations today. I'm Nicholas Bocconi, CEO of Mammoth Leadership Sciences. After the Civil War ended, Caesar did not empty Rome of his enemies. He allowed them back, and many returned, some cautiously, some out of necessity, others simply because there was nowhere else to go. The system still needed them. Experienced men, connected men, men who understood how Rome functioned. So they came back. Men like him. He takes his seat, nodding to a colleague across the aisle. A man who had switched sides earlier and aligned himself with Caesar before the final battles. Their eyes meet briefly, and in that moment there is recognition, but also distance, because the past has not disappeared. It has simply been folded into the present. The sessions begin. A proposal is introduced, something administrative, almost routine, the kind of issue that would once have triggered a real debate. He listens as others speak, noticing how carefully they choose their words, how they circle around certain points rather than pushing directly through them. When his turn comes, he hesitates. Not long enough for anyone to call it out, just a fraction of a second, but enough for him to feel it. There was a time when he would have spoken with conviction, challenged assumptions, tested the argument. That instinct is still there, rising almost automatically. Yet something else rises with it. A question. Not about the proposal itself, but about the room, about how his words will land, about whether this is a moment to stand out or to stay within the line that no one has formally drawn, yet everyone seems to understand. He speaks carefully, measured, controlled, technically sound, but stripped of the edge it once carried. He sits back down and tells himself it was the right choice. Across the chamber, another man approaches the same moment differently. He had adapted early, saw the shift coming, adjusted his position, and aligned himself with Caesar before the outcome was certain. Now he speaks with confidence, his tone steady, and his arguments clear, so that from the outside he looks like a winner. Inside, the calculation never stops. He knows how quickly positions can change, how alignment today does not guarantee security tomorrow, and so he stays close to the center, attentive, responsive, always just ahead of where he thinks the direction is going. It works, but it is not the same as belief. And then there is a third man who says nothing at all. Not today, not yesterday, not for some time now. He attends, observes, votes when required, but avoids exposure. Once he had been known for his voice, for his willingness to challenge, to argue, to take positions others would avoid. Now he listens. He has made a different calculation, one in which speaking carries risk while silence, for now, does not. None of these men have been removed. They are still there, still part of the system, still holding roles that suggest continuity, so that from the outside this looks like stability. Rome has endured, its leadership remains intact, and its institutions still function. But inside the room, something else has taken shape. Each of them has adjusted, not just in behavior, but in their sense of self. The man who once saw himself as a defender of the Republic now thinks of himself as a survivor, while the one who adapted early sees himself as pragmatic, even strategic, though he avoids asking too directly what that has cost him. The silent one tells himself that patience is wisdom, that there will be a time to act again. Maybe. This is what defeat looks like when it's not final. They have not been destroyed. They have been absorbed. And absorption changes people. It changes how they speak, how they think, how they decide what matters, narrowing what feels possible, reshaping what feels worth the risk, and quietly redrawing the boundaries of identity. For Julius Caesar, this creates a system that works. He is surrounded by experienced men who continue to operate, who keep the machinery of Rome moving, who maintain the appearance of continuity. They comply, they contribute, they adapt. But they are not the same men as they were before. And that matters, because what a leader inherits after victory is not just structure, not just roles, not just capability. It is people. People who remember where they stood, people who have recalculated their place, people who may align outwardly, but carrying something very different beneath the surface. This is a hidden reality of any transition where there are winners and losers. You do not start fresh. You start with history, sitting quietly in the room. Next time, we follow Caesar further into power, where the absence of open opposition begins to change the quality of what he hears, where agreement becomes easier to find, and where the distance between authority and reality begins to narrow in ways that will not remain manageable. All right, what does this leave us with as modern leaders? If you want to take away only two things from this episode, it would be these. First, when you bring people from a losing side into your team, do not assume that alignment follows automatically. Pay attention to how they show up, because some will adapt quickly, others will hold back, and some will disengage quietly. Your role is to understand those differences and create conditions where people can rebuild identity, not just perform a role. And secondly, recognize that compliance is not the same as commitment. Just because people contribute does not mean they believe. And if you want long-term strength, you need to actively rebuild trust, address what has been lost, and create a shared sense of purpose that goes beyond the outcome of the transition. The question for leaders is not only how to integrate people, but who those people have become by the time they join you. All right, this was it again for today. If this episode resonated with you, whether as a leader, a student of history, or someone curious about why power unfolds the way it does, please subscribe, rate, and share it with someone in your network who would appreciate this kind of perspective. And lastly, if you're interested in more, you can order my book. It has the same title as this podcast, The Mammoth in the Room, and it offers a practical roadmap for how great leaders and their teams embrace evolutionary truths for outstanding business results. I'm doing that in three sections, on people, on strategy, and on implementation. Until next time, lead wisely, think critically, and don't let ancient instincts quietly hijack your modern leadership. I'm Nicholas Bocconi, and this is The Mammoth in the Room.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy this content, don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you on the next episode of The Mammoth in the Room.